In 2012, from here, it was very hard to leave Hartford, but I really made that move when I had an invitation to take a new chair in Islamic studies at Huron University College, because it was close to my family. I have a big family. I have a big nuclear family, a big extended family. It was, I mean, if I have any riches, it's my family, and I really was not benefiting from that. I know so many people who don't even have brothers and sisters, so to have all of this wealth and not benefiting from it seemed like almost an act of ingratitude to God in a way. So very fortunately, God guided me back there, and so I was able to immediately move into my mother's house and spend the next few months with her until she died. She died within 2 months of the diagnosis, actually. Went from 100% healthy to returning to her Lord. And, you know, our family had been through a lot. My father died suddenly when my mother was 43. Both of them were 43 years old. They had 7 kids between the ages of 10 and 20 at that time. So my mother lived exactly twice as long as my father did. We lost our youngest brother in a tragic kayaking accident 20 years before, and then my daughter had just died, just, you know, only half a year earlier. So we'd gone through a lot in our lives, and through it all, I have to say that, you know, our mother really was our teacher. She was an incredible person who had such modesty, humility, generosity, strength, and allowed each of her children to realize their God-given capacities, and those included their spiritual capacities. So somehow our family found ourselves in the position of having a Jewish sister, a Catholic sister, a Muslim sister, a couple of atheists, and some who just kind of undecided. But we, you know, she kept us all together, and we were all kind of afraid what would happen when Mom would die, because she was the glue. But I tell you, in those 2 months, and it may sound strange to people, but you're chaplains, so I know you're going to understand what I mean when I say this. Those 2 months, for all of us, were the best 2 months of our lives. While my mother was losing all of her capacities, her physical health, her, you know, slowly fading away, she made more and more room for each of us. And in that time, it was extraordinary, because here we were, I'm the youngest, so at that time I would have been 55 or so. The oldest was already over 60. But the gifts of each of my siblings that unfolded during that time were a revelation. I mean, we could see my oldest brother, Hal, who was just constantly focused on every aspect of the situation. My sister Peggy, was so physical. She would jump into bed, you know, in the hospital bed right beside my mother and be right beside her, but she couldn't touch the medicine. So my other sister and I, we were the ones who were able to administer the medicines right till the end, you know, the sub-Q morphine. The brother with the beer shirt, yes, who was like some kind of like one of those ancient Greek like half animal, half human, who's just like at the threshold, forbidding any evil presence from coming through. He was there, whether she was in the hospital, at home. He was on the couch or on the chair, right in front, and to make sure that nothing would pass that was a problem. So it was an extraordinary moment. And then she left, and we said prayers in every faith, and we sang songs, and we told stories, we recounted, you know, the family stories over and over and over. And I remembered to do that because my mother had done the same thing for her mother 20 years ago when she and her sister and brother were gathered around their mother as she died actually from the same form of cancer in the same home in the next room. And I remember her telling me about her brother just even when my grandmother was unconscious, still talking to her and still telling stories of love and family and connection and joy. So I said, okay, she taught me that. She told me that. I have to tell those stories too. And then she was gone. And all of that growth that we experienced remained. And now we were six new people, and we had a new kind of relationship. After having, you know, 50 to 60 years together already, our relationships were new. So it taught me a lot about what it means to prepare people for their life. And when it is what it means to be present and what it means to be absent. And both states are necessary at different times. And God will prepare us for those states. So I was thinking about that really when I'm thinking about what is the purpose and the place of chaplaincy. Now, I've read some of the reports and some of the statements and, you know, that younger generations are less religious and more spiritual and maybe, you know, is our purpose shifting and are we still relevant? But I want to say this is the most relevant and the most purposeful thing that anyone could do at a university, at a higher education institute, where people are coming into their capacities, you know, coming into their emotional, physical, spiritual, intellectual capacities all together. How important it is to be that shepherd. How are we going to the next slide?
Here we go.
All right, there we go. Okay, we'll see. Clicker? Oh, nope. Nope. Well, that's the end. Ooh, okay. Let's see. Nope. Okay, let's start at the beginning again, maybe. It's not quite the beginning. How do I go back? There we go. Okay. Now, if I want to go to the next one, yes, there we go. All right. Yes. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about the path, the well-worn path, the almost tired metaphor of the path, but stick with me for a few minutes. The metaphor of the path is widespread among religious and spiritual traditions and other disciplines as well. The Quran says, "For each community, we have established paths and roads." Of course, Sharia in Islam means the way towards the divine. Muslims pray in every prayer, "Guide us to the straight path." A legal school, of which there are many in the Islamic tradition, is called a madhab, while the countless Sufi schools of spiritual practice are known as tariqa, which means a path. All different words for path. Is one of those waters mine? These guys are listening so attentively, they're not paying attention to my requests. All right, mashallah. Now, the diversity of paths mentioned raises the question of whether all ways lead to God. This is a deep and contested theological and metaphysical issue. This is one of those questions that will remain perpetually the topic of discussion and debate. But while theologians and metaphysicians will debate this question, I ask, what is the relevance for the spiritual counselor, the pastoral caregiver, or the chaplain? The Quran says, "You do not guide whom you like, rather it is God who guides whom he wills to the path." God guides, we do not. Our purpose and our place is illuminated in the statement of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, who said, Removing harmful things from the road is an act of charity. So helping others by removing obstacles that block their path to God is at the heart of spiritual and pastoral care, as is advising them on the equipment, getting them in shape, maybe helping them carry their pack along the way. What can block the path to God? What can block the path to fullness of oneself? What can block the path of those who seek what is good and right? All too often, it is other people from one's own community who put up illegal roadblocks. These vigilantes of religion claim they have the authority to prevent others from moving forward. How many times have I heard from students that they began a good project only to be told by one of these self-appointed religious police, another student, that they were not allowed to speak or act in one fashion or another? So where the space is completely unregulated, very often it's the strongest, the most pushy, the most obnoxious who will get their way. So what is our responsibility? Our responsibility is to deconstruct the authority that these people claim to have, to perhaps demonstrate the structural flaws and the barriers they have erected, or maybe even help take them down. What do we have to offer? We have knowledge of history, theology, ethics, ancient and more recent teachings, as well as logic and legal disputation, to show that the road is wide. And if they can't take down the barriers, sometimes they can just walk right around them and remain headed in the right direction. People can become diverted and distracted from moving forward by loud and disturbing events, by frightening scenes, by new situations. They become frozen with fear or fascination and might stop moving completely. The spiritual caregiver can put the distraction into perspective and draw people's attention back to the path. An Arabic proverb says, "The dogs bark, but the caravan moves on." In these situations, we can help remind people to give proper attention to threats, not to become paralyzed by them. In concrete terms, this often means paying less attention to, you know, some social media troll or the latest loudmouth self-styled expert on the news, and more on one's spiritual and educational goals, the needs of one's family and community building. We all know that the best thing that a teacher can do is to equip students with the tools to clear the path themselves. Unfortunately, many religious leaders and even those who are caregivers engender dependency in those who have come to them for help. This is a complex process because the relationship is often initiated by those who are so disempowered they have no confidence in their own abilities. What they seek is a father or a mother figure to carry them forward. The confidence and admiration they have in the religious figure is flattering. This is where one's sincerity is tested. The goal of the pastoral caregiver or the spiritual caregiver should not be to attract followers, but to help others build up their strength and learn what they need to move ahead. Certainly, there will always be particularly treacherous places along the way that require specialized training to surmount. In the life of a believer, these include deep trauma, breach of trust in families, and making decisions on complex ethical issues. The religious leader should be, and the pastoral leader should be on call to help resolve these harmful situations, but then should be able to step aside to allow people to continue on their way. As pastoral caregivers, all pastoral caregivers have at their core a deep natural impulse to intervene. When we see something wrong or notice an opportunity for improvement. But without self-awareness, without supervision, without knowledge and skills, we can become nothing more than agitators or busybodies. Without humility and an awareness of our own limits, we can end up being demagogues or even bullies. But none of us can see who we are without looking in the mirror. The Prophet Muhammad said, "A believer is a mirror to another believer." So the caregiver who does not want to become a pothole in the path of others, don't worry, I've almost exhausted this road metaphor, needs to seek plenty of feedback from others. It can be scary out there. But there is a role for us. For those, this is my teacher, and then my successor in leadership at ISNA. And when I love this picture because when I look at it, I know that each one of us who all served in the same role at one point or another have completely different leadership styles, different grounding and education, very different personalities. But there's a place, I believe, for every style of service, and there are those who need different kinds of people. No one will be the right person or the right supporter for everyone, even if we try very hard to do that. Who are we? Who are the pastoral caregivers? Who are the spiritual caregivers? They are the shepherd, Bilal Ansari, your master's thesis, very good one, on shepherding the community. The warm host, hospitality chaplaincy, Greg Boyce from New Zealand. The wise elder, coming from Canada, where I live now, this is a very strong presence in our country, our Indigenous elders in particular, to the point that the example or the role model of an Indigenous elder is being embraced by many in the Muslim community as well as a term that they like more than chaplaincy. Mm-hmm. Because after all, the word sheikh simply means elder. And Sheikha, elder, woman, man and woman. What is the elder? The elder is the person who carries the stories, who's able to tell you what happened and how they did it and what they heard. And the narrative tradition of the elder is so powerful because it's never direct. It's not directive. It's not instructing people that they have to do something, but it allows for this imaginative displacement of self in another scenario where one then can travel through the example or the experience of previous people and through that start to embody some of those qualities and learn empathy by standing in the shoes of the people that came before them. Really, we would call this in many ways a wisdom tradition. We have teachers who pass knowledge, and knowledge is important because the only correction or medicine for disinformation or for untruth or for fake news is knowledge, is truth, and there's a lot of it out there. There's a distinction in Islamic ethics between simple ignorance and complex ignorance, jahl basit and jahl murakkab. Jahl basit is simple ignorance, is just someone says, you know, I don't know anything about this. Complex ignorance is where someone believes they know something, what is right, what is wrong, what are the rules, what is allowed or not, but it is incorrect. And to deconstruct knowledge, to help people give up what they've They've actually embodied, because knowledge is embodied, it is in us. It is actually more difficult physically to correct misinformation than to learn new information, because we're building new pathways, right? So knowledge is key, but it's not always, you know, the problem is not always lack of knowledge or misinformation. And so knowledge is not enough. So we have the teacher passing knowledge, we have the guide, as I said, showing people how to prepare for the journey and how to navigate obstacles to keep moving. We have the watcher, the one who pays attention, who sees, and this is a big quality of being a pastoral caregiver, or a spiritual caregiver, or a chaplain in a community setting, to pay attention to how people are interacting and behaving with each other, how they're moving. I think I have a big, beautiful shepherd mix dog who does just that. I mean, I think that kind of attentiveness, if someone wants to learn how to, in a group, pay attention to what's happening and to understand the dynamics, just watch the shepherd dog watching the people. They see before an action happens what's going to happen, because they pay such close attention to the body language, to the tension, the energy that is relaxed or tense. So we have the watcher, we have the listener. Oh boy, that's so important, as you know. When everyone is so busy today that they don't have time to wait for the troubles to be unpacked and laid out, it takes time to unpack those troubles, and we're in a rush. What is the purpose of chaplaincy? Huge purpose is listening, because so many people have no one who will listen to them. The advocate when things are unfair, and that happens certainly in a higher education setting. The connector, the celebrant, the interpreter of the past, the convener of the present, the facilitator to the future. The chaplain is a sign, one of God's signs. Ibn Ata'illah, one of the great spiritual masters of Islam, says, by the existence of his created things, he points to the existence of his names. And by the existence of his names, he points to the existence of his qualities. And by the existence of his qualities, he points to the reality of his essence. In other words, a chaplain is a person. And we are people who need people. We are persons who need other persons who show us, who embody to us, who are present with us, so that we can move forward. Resilience is, I know there was a talk today on resilience I saw on the schedule. Resilience is not just what you think, but what you, not just what you think, but what you have. And I really like the statement of, how many of you have read anything by Michael Unger? He has, there's the Resilience Research Center in Halifax, in Canada. It's an amazing center. The work that he's done is really, I think, very extraordinary. It's about resilience that is not just about ideas, not about what you're thinking, but actually what you have. And I love his seven principles for building resilience in community. And I think it applies very much also to higher education chaplaincy. So Unger says, these are the seven pillars of building resilience in community. One, building relationships. Two, encouraging powerful identities. Three, providing participants with opportunities for power and control. Four, promoting social justice. 5, improving access to basic material needs like food, housing, and safety. And we're going to talk a little bit more in chaplaincy, in higher education chaplaincy, what all of these things, what examples would be. 6, developing a sense of belonging, responsibility for others, spirituality, and life purpose. And Michael Unger does not, he's talking about the pillars of resilience in any setting. It doesn't have to be in a religious setting. So this works for, you know, for students or members of the community who might have a faith or might not have a faith tradition or might not affiliate with a religious tradition, but everyone has an ability to connect with a sense of purpose, and 7, a sense of culture and historical roots. So that his center has done so many scientific studies that shows that, you know, it's really important to understand, unlike those who are just trying to sell us on a very individualistic sense of wellness, that wellness is about being connected. It's being connected with the past, with the present, with being embedded and enmeshed in relationships, and with having resources. It's not just an attitude. And certainly, I think it's important to begin when we think about the resources for higher education chaplaincy is to really begin with religious freedom. Because I think this is something we take for granted. And one of the reasons why we should be somewhat careful about how we talk about chaplaincy and not be too quick, you know, not everyone's religious, but at the same time to hold on to the religious chaplaincy is that religion is protected. It's a protected right, right? So there is a right to religious freedom and accommodation that one might not necessarily have in terms of a personal spiritual practice. Now that this is a legal matter, but I do think we have to be very careful because much of what has been built up in terms of chaplaincy has been on the basis of the law, and many times lawsuits, and it's supported by that. And so it doesn't mean that we have to put every form of chaplaincy into the religious box, but we shouldn't give it up. It's a really powerful foundation. And it is the most important for most people, because whether they want to affiliate with one of the student groups, one of the faith-based student groups, or whether they want to take advantage of the chaplaincy services or not, in the end, they should have freedom and facilitation. And it's being taken away in many places, and we often think, you know, by now we know we can't say, oh, it wouldn't happen in America. We've just lived through the last couple years where there's so many things that we think couldn't happen in America, so we should be very careful. I just want to contrast these two pictures. So, religion, spirituality, perhaps, wellness, same setting, people moving their body in a public outdoor space, a group together, but very often this scenario or this manifestation of someone bringing their whole self to that space will make people uncomfortable in a way that no one will bat an eye at for this. And I think this shows, you know, I'm not going to tell people what they think, but I do know from conversations with many students is that they will say they're spiritual, not religious, not because they're not religious, but because they think that people don't like religious people. And so they're packaging themselves in a more palatable way. And again, there are those who are not religious, and they absolutely mean, you know, what they say, I'm spiritual or I'm ethical, I don't have any faith or spiritual religious tradition, but there are a lot of people who are religious who are concealing that and trying to present it as something more palatable. We need religious freedom, we need safety. Our students need safety. They need safety today, they need safety on campus. It's not just the feeling of being unsafe, but there is a reality of not being safe. And if any institution, if any administrator at a higher education, you know, the higher education administrators don't think that this is a problem, we could go through a very quick list just over the last few years. Why is it important to have a safe space? And it's safe in terms of physically safe. It's also safe in terms of emotionally safe. Now, I'm not saying no free speech. What I'm saying is there is so much hateful speech. Mm. That is the you know, water that many are swimming in when it comes to religion, that there does need to be spaces that are faith positive or religion positive. And not just, you know, as an individual, but I belong to a religious tradition or a faith tradition, this faith community, and to feel that there's, you know, there's an acceptance of that, there's a welcoming of that, there's a celebration of that space. No matter how much people want to, you know, the tendency in society is to make everything about the inner self, the individual. People have group feeling, as Ibn Khaldun said. Mm-hmm. We're social beings. We will find a community. And there are some really ugly identifications that people can be attracted to. Our history, our culture, our identity, right? There's a lot of ugliness out there, and when we displace the religious feeling, and again, you know, some people are religious, some people aren't, that does not displace the need for purpose and meaning in our lives. And sometimes it is, you know, unfortunately, one of the most powerful group feelings is that engendered by war. With all of its religious kind of metaphors, like he will live in our heart forever, or the eternal flame, or the greatest sacrifice, and not to dismiss those sacrifices, or those struggles, or those people, but to say that it's unrealistic to believe that it's enough simply to support people in their individual growth and not pay attention to the collective dynamics of meaning, meaning-making and purpose-making. Of course, chaplaincy is all about welcome, making a welcoming space, making, you know, why do, I love the word cozy, and you just see so many people in search of coziness, right? What are all those Scandinavian words that mean cozy? So what is that? What it means is that people want to feel like at home and sheltered and welcomed, and like the coziness is also, you know how I always found it so remarkable that when my kids were little and we'd be at our family cottage with all their cousins, and there'd be like maybe 15 cousins, and you'd walk in the room, there's three couches there. All 15 are sitting on one couch. Like two of them are empty, and there's just like the others are all just piled on top of each other and squeezed in. Why? Because it's, we need that like physicality, that coziness. And it's hard to get that in many places in the university or the college. You know, sitting in rows in the classroom, these hard desks in the library, and like, where are they getting that? So I think that this is a simple but a really important part of making people feel just having that place of rest, of relief, of feeling safe and in community. Our religious traditions that we can help students connect with if they are interested, the religious and spiritual traditions, are very, very rich. I mean, there is such a great heritage. So much art, poetry, music, architecture. The richness of this tradition, and what's amazing is that different people get different things out of these traditions. Some are focused on the knowledge, some are focused on the ambience, some are focused on the aesthetics. And we, you know, all of these things are studied in different departments at the university, the fine arts department and literature and architecture. But when we come together for those moments of being in community, in a faith community, a religious community, a spiritual community, even a humanistic community, there's an integration that happens. An integration through lineage, through history, through heritage, that allows this is not my main goal, but I know that sometimes we have to justify chaplaincy in higher education. How often, I know as a professor, how often are we being told that one of the outcomes of education is to have this like integration of knowledge, and there are all these really artificial ways academically that it's being done, but it can be done in a more embodied, holistic, natural way through spending time in these spaces where all of these things are integrated. Some people, as you know, are just going to need to fly free. I mean, that tradition, that heritage, that authority, that knowledge is a burden to them. It has been something that has been used in a way that has blocked their capacities, and those people need to be, you know, able to fly free. And that's also the role for chaplaincy, because when people have been spiritually harmed or harmed by how the religious tradition is being presented to them, that very often, and I see it with many students in higher education, there's a sense of guilt, there's a burden, they feel they need to separate at least for some time or from some spaces, but they feel very burdened by that and guilt-ridden by that many times. And that's one of the important roles, is to help people detach in a healthy way when they need to do that. And I think that really coming from within the tradition and being able to have those examples, there are always those examples of those who just, you know, needed to be a part, whether it's the monastic tradition or the retreat tradition or those, you know, those wandering ascetics or even the wandering, you know, partiers, whatever it is, like there's different ways to do it. Sometimes people just need to detach, and I think that the chaplain can facilitate that in a way that when someone does it on their own, they still, you know, often carry this burden with them. And it's very heavy, and they might seek mental health care for it. But the tools and the knowledge for helping that person feel more liberated are often very limited in that context. Of course, tying into the intellectual inquiry, which is going on all over at the university, but not all of our students are studying theology or religious studies or these traditions. They're studying other disciplines, but they need opportunities to connect with intellectual inquiry, some academic studies, some ongoing development in the community, because most come from, you know, their parochial setting, and they haven't been exposed to much of the really exciting, new, interesting studies and literature that will help them, again, mature as a spiritual person. I'm getting near the end. Of course, we're all here and everywhere. We are all big fans of connecting with our extended family of faith, which is how I think of interfaith work. I always think of my faith community as like my nuclear family of faith, and the interfaith or multi-faith community as my extended family. And we may not, I spend more time with my immediate family, my nuclear family, my siblings, but I'm gonna go hang out with my cousins every once in a while, you know, or go visit my aunt. I just went cross-country skiing with my cousin the other day. She called me up, we're so happy. It's been a kind of a blowout as a winter for snow, so we had enough snow that we went skiing on the golf course. So that was, you know, I connect with her a couple times a year, but it gives us this expanded sense of self. And that expanded sense of self is becoming, you know, fortunately for many of us, certainly, and for increasing numbers of our community, part of their religious or spiritual identity is that they have these, you know, circles of spiritual and faith community that are expanding out. And that is such an important part of how this profession and this way of being in the world has developed over time, because we really, you know, we really need to have a sense that we're not just on the margins. You know, it takes away that sense of marginalization and isolation, which can be very problematic, because it can lead, you know, it can lead to all sorts of behaviors that are and ways of seeing oneself that are not very healthy. And I'm going to wrap up here. I want to say that I do think that, I don't know how many of you do this, but when I follow a lot of, I see my students, I see them, you know, in later, because I'm also a community leader, so I see them after they've graduated, you know, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years down the line. And one of the things that I see is that we're not necessarily doing a great job all the time preparing them for what comes next. So what comes next is that cozy feeling. You're not going to have the same intense environment, you know, the crucible of the university or college atmosphere. And very often what they'll do is they'll blame themselves. They'll say, oh, you know, I don't have the same enthusiasm that I did when I was in the university. Or they blame others. They're like, what's wrong with people? People used to be so good and they used to care about each other. But not really understanding that they're in a different context, right? And also that their responsibilities have changed. And then also, like, who is helping them prepare? Now, you know, some students have very strong families. They have faith communities. But I think we could do a little bit more, especially in that maybe the last year, of helping those who come to campus chaplaincies prepare for the future, prepare for the inevitable kind of a little bit like you know, maybe going from this intense feeling to being less so, but that's okay. And just explaining what it's going to look like over the next, you know, 5-10 years. I get texts all the time or emails or messages from students who are just really often looking back and saying, oh, those were the great days, those were the best days, because I feel that they just transitioned from their higher education setting to, you know, the broader community, and they didn't necessarily have the skills. So we need to do that. And I'm just simply going to end here with just some nice pictures, because I like these pictures. because look, you know, faith, spirituality, it's about awe, it's about joy, it's about connection. We have to be part of this creation. We have to take time, we have to notice, we have to look out the window sometimes. Sometimes we're so busy, you know, in our meeting that we don't look out the window or we don't step outside. So, and very often when people disappoint us, the living creation, the living beings of creation and life itself does not fail to disappoint, and can make us understand that, as the Quran says, God has made the whole world a mosque, a place of prostration, a place that is pure and for prayer and for remembrance of God, so that as we step outside of the campus from this crucible of spiritual formation and development, that there's a big world and it's scary sometimes, but it's also beautiful, and it's also where we belong. We never are, we're never lost, we're never not supposed to be in this world. So with that, I'll end, so we have some time for discussion.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mattson. I'm going to invite Imam Soheib Sultan to offer a reflection and question to get the conversation started.
You want people to...
And then after you offer some initial conversations, we'll open it up to the floor.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Greetings of peace and blessings to all of you. It's my great honor and privilege to be offering some words of reflection. I know that what I was called upon was to respond, but I don't think I can ever really be a respondent to my teacher, Dr. Mattson. I can just reflect on some things that she has said. And the first thing that I'll say is that her words today, you know, went to the heart of what we do as chaplains. It was both inspirational and descriptive, and it was prescriptive at the same time, and it reminded me as to why I missed this place, being a student at Hartford Seminary, spending a lot of hours and days in the good company of my teacher, Dr. Mattson. And so it feels really nice to be back home, and it feels really nice to be in the presence of so many people that I love, including the people on this stage. Unlike our previous morning session, where the respondent had the paper from beforehand and had a chance to think about what they were going to say, Dr. Mattson, you know, one thing that I've come to know about Muslim teaching and preaching is that we love to do it, you know, off the cuff, and you know, and it comes off. When it comes from people like Dr. Mattson, it's brilliant. When it comes from people like me, it's rambling. What I'm going to do today is basically go through my notes and offer some thoughts. I tried to circle some things, so I hope you'll bear with me patiently. You know, I wanted to start with where Dr. Mattson started. This idea of thinking deeply about the storytellers of our families and about the power that our elders have taught us about being people who carry stories and transmit stories. And what you shared, Dr. Mattson, was just so moving. And it reminds me that very recently on my own campus, I asked my father to come and be in conversation with me. And we called it Stories from My Father. You may have heard that title before, but hopefully it's not copyrighted. Right. But we did that because, as some of you know, my parents actually live with me in our humble home with my wife and our three-year-old daughter for the last 10-plus years. And it's a multi-generational home and a multi-generational experience filled with a lot of joy and a lot of challenges, to be very honest with you. And oftentimes my father and I share beautiful moments because he is the one who taught me to love my community. And being able to share what I'm doing at work every day with him and my mother is really powerful. It's also challenging because he and I often misalign on our visions for what the community should look like. And sometimes we have very different notions of how things should be done, and sometimes we have these clashes. And so one day, my father and I were standing in the kitchen for almost an hour, unexpectedly engaging in a very long debate about a matter of communal importance. I'll just leave it at that. And my wife, who is an Instagram master, suddenly, unknown to either one of us, started taking pictures from the side and posted it on her Instagram page and said, "Father and son in debate." And, you know, my father was very posed and dignified, and I was like this and like that. You know, I looked like a complete fool. So thanks to my wife for that. And so somebody in the comment section said, "You should bring this live. You should bring this, you know, you should bring this out to the community." I didn't think that was quite appropriate, but it did make me think about the fact that probably one of the greatest resources that I have in my own personal life is the life of my parents and the fact that they're still present and able. And so I decided to have this conversation, and it was a really, really beautiful thing to be able to just ask my father to share the stories to my community that I grew up with. And there's a few stories that he shared that I had never heard of, and I said, "Abu, you never told me these stories," and he said, "You never asked." So that was a lesson as well. And it makes me think about this idea of, I think the quote that I'm gonna take away from Dr. Mattson's talk is, chaplaincy is about what it means to prepare people for their life, right? I think that's something to think about a lot. And to remove obstacles from the path, right? And I think that so much of it is about having this model of conversation. You know, when I first came to Princeton University, fresh from Hartford Seminary, fresh from, you know, the classroom of Dr. Mattson, you know, I used to host this, you know, event series that used to try to educate people about Islam, and I used to always bring people to come and give lectures, you know. And after a while, I started to see that this was almost a very academic model, and there's nothing chaplaincy about it, right? Somebody just comes and gives a talk, and you know, everyone goes home. Some people go home, right? So I started thinking about how should I be putting on events that are not just reflective of the academic atmosphere that I'm in, but are reflective of the chaplaincy training that I have. And so after a few years of finally, you know, something clicking, I said, no longer will people come and give lectures. People will come even if they're the most well-known thinker and scholar out there, they're going to come and be in conversation.
Yes.
And I'm going to try to model what it looks like to have a respectful dialogue and even difference, and then open it up to our audience. So I think this idea of allowing our students space, I think that's one thing Dr. Mattson talked about, you know, giving people space, right? Just like her mother gave her children space to be their best, to come into their own. We need to give students space, and that space happens when there's conversation, when there's exchange, when there's hospitality, when there's intimacy. It doesn't happen from the pulpit to the congregation. Speaking of hospitality, I think that one of the greatest challenges that we as campus chaplains, I think, often face is how to, on the one hand, have a ministry of hospitality. And with hospitality comes a level of intimacy, right? Because you share your home and your food and your drinks and all of that with people who you're trying to draw close to and to whom you want to be close. How do you, on the one hand, have that ministry of hospitality and at the same time offer the type of pastoral care that's based in confidentiality, a pastoral care that's based in people sharing their deepest and darkest secrets, and then experiencing those same people in community, and also being, also doing other things as a religious leader without ever allowing them to feel that you are violating their trust or violating some confidence that they have put in you. For example, when you're preaching from the pulpit, right, or you're preaching at, on in any particular setting, how do you talk about issues of concern in the community while also maintaining the confidence of people? So I think this is something that, as I think about chaplaincy as hospitality, it's something that I both love and that I'm also challenged by. And I'd love to hear all of your thoughts about that as well. In all of the things that Dr. Mattson was talking about that makes up a chaplain, one of the things that I had never heard of before but makes a lot of sense is the watcher, right? I really like that. You know, just kind of watching and just kind of taking it in and seeing how people in your community are doing and being very observant of body language, right? I think that that is the mark of a good chaplain, that they're aware of what's happening in the community. And I remember recently there's a freshman who, you know, is struggling to fit into the community, partly because he lacks certain social skills. And this is actually quite common at a place like Princeton University. Because it's like if you've made it to a place like Princeton, you've definitely missed out on something, right? Right? You can't make it to Princeton and, you know, also have everything else, right? And a lot of students really struggle with social skills. And I remember this student, he came to me once and, you know, he said to me, I just feel like nobody here wants to talk to me, you know. I said to him, you know, I love it when you smile. And I'd love to see you smile more. Maybe if you smile more, people will smile back at you, and that'll be an invitation for people to talk to you, you know. And so now every single time he sees me, he always looks in my direction, he smiles. You know, so this idea of being the watcher, being someone who can then guide people based on what we've observed, out of that sincere love and compassion for them, and doing it in a way that's gentle, that makes them feel that their dignity has not been violated, that they've been helped along, and that roadblocks, maybe internal roadblocks, have been removed. I want to think together about this idea of spaces on campus where people feel faith affirmed, feel faith positive. And there's no doubt about the fact that these spaces are so essential and so necessary. And I think this is a conversation I would love to engage more and more in, is to what should our spiritual and religious centers and places look like? What should they feel like? You know, certainly we heard about this idea of aesthetics, about beauty. We certainly heard about this idea of hospitality. One of the big questions, I think, right now in college chaplaincy is whether these spaces should be multi-faith, or should every faith community, or at least every major faith community on campus, have their own space out of which they are inviting others to be in relationship. And this is, I think, going to be a very difficult question. When I first came to Princeton University, I asked, you know, the key student leaders who were involved, I said, you know, if we're successful in 5 to 10 years from now, what would be our mark of success? And almost unanimously, they said, we're going to have a center for Muslim life. And I said, why? And they said, because there's a center for Jewish life. And I said, okay, that doesn't sound like a good enough reason, right? Right? So basically their model was, there's this other significant religious minority on campus, and they are, their mark of success has been, is having this really gorgeous, beautiful center to which they're able to invite people who are able to learn about Judaism and Shabbat and about all these rich traditions of the Jewish culture. And we should have a space like that too, right? But at Princeton University, like many other many of your campuses, we also have a multi-faith center. And there's a beauty about the multi-faith center, which is, in our context, called Murray Dodge Hall, in that every single day, the Buddhist has to encounter the Muslim, and the Hindu has to encounter the Christian, and the Sikh has to encounter the agnostic who's just wandering around, right? And I remember that every single time, you know, the Buddhist meditation room and the Muslim prayer room are on the same floor. And so Muslims, they tend to be very chatty after prayer. You know, like after they leave prayer, they're just like, hey, you know, right? They're very loud, right? And the Buddhists always were meditating at 4:30 p.m. on the same floor. And we were finishing our early afternoon Asr prayer around that time. And, you know, inevitably, you know, there was this clash between the Buddhists meditating in silence and the Muslims so happy that they just finished their prayer, you know, and excited to chat about that for some reason. And so every single day at Asr, I'm like, shh, be quiet, we're gonna get in trouble, right? But we had to negotiate how we were going to be together as Buddhists and Muslims at 4:30 p.m. on the third floor of the multi-faith center, right? And I don't think that we would ever have that experience if we had our Muslim life center. Right? But of course, then there's other things that we're missing out on by not having our Muslim Life Center. You know, the space isn't entirely built for Muslim worship and contemplation. It's not even built for being a 21st century multi-faith center. Right? So this is a big question that I think, you know, emerges in chaplaincy for us. All right, I'm almost done. What did I write here? Oh, yes. You know, I really, really enjoyed thinking about this piece, Dr. Madsen, that you talked about, which is the idea that part of what chaplains do is to help people detach and to help people go into retreat, and that all of our traditions, all of our religious and spiritual traditions have this notion of, you know, going away, right? But how does the chaplain, and I would love to talk more about this with all of you, about what are the methods? How do we teach our students to do this? How do you detach and then re-engage, right? There's this beautiful tradition in Islam regarding the spiritual biography of the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, that, you know, God takes him on this incredible journey through the heavens and ultimately to a meeting place with his Lord. And after a while, he comes back to the world. And many of the Islamic philosophers, including Allama Iqbal, one of the great South Asian poets, he said that the difference between the path of the mystics and the path of the prophets is that if Muhammad, upon him be peace, was only a mystic and not a prophet, there's no way he would ever come back. He would be like, I'm meeting with my Lord, I will not come back. Nothing can bring me back, right? But the way of the prophets is to have those brilliant encounters by yourself in retreat, and then to come back and infuse that energy into the world. So I'd love to think more about that. You know, how do we help our students who need to take a break? You know, it's so unnatural, right? To go from K to 12th grade and then straight to college, it's just so unnatural. I think, I often tell my students, the ones that I'm close to and who will understand where I'm coming from, I tell them that college is wasted on a lot of young people, right? It's like millions of dollars are wasted on giving young people resources, and all these young people need is a break, you know? And so how do we create a culture where it's okay to take a break? I feel like at Princeton University, for example, when someone takes a break, they're almost punished. You know, you're no longer part of your class. If you're no longer part of your class, you lack social cohesion. You're not graduating on time. And there's this taboo. People are ashamed that they had to take time off. People are ashamed that they had to have a mental, not that they had to have a mental breakdown, but they had a mental breakdown, right? There's so much shame around that. But it's only natural when we put people through, you know, such an unnatural environment. So I'd love to think more about that. And the last thing that I'd say that I really loved is this idea of preparing people for the future. And so, in fact, just last year, after all these years, it's like, what was I doing, right? But after all these years, finally, you know, my wife and I hosted the senior class for 4 dinners at our home, and we called it adulting, right? Right? And over the course of those 4 dinners, we talked about marriage, we talked about finding a spiritual and religious life after you graduate from college, we talked about how to be in the workplace, challenges and struggles of being in the workplace, and we talked about other such things. And we brought people from the community who could help them. And I think that that's a really great thing to think about, how to prepare our students, our beloveds, for the future. The last thing that I'll say, which I would pose as a question to Dr. Madsen, is that, you know, you said a lot about, you know, our role toward our students and toward the campus community. But I'd love to hear more about what is now commonly being referred to as self-care among chaplains. And I personally find this extremely, extremely difficult. I don't know about the rest of you all, right? But it's so challenging, right? Like, first of all, just to vent for a moment, right? You know, it's almost impossible to go to a mosque or a Muslim religious place just as a normal worshiper and devotee and just to kind of, right? Like every time you go, oh, you're here, come lead prayer. Oh, you're here, come say some words. No, I just want to, right? So that's challenging. And then I think there's also the reality that so much of our work involves listening, being present, putting our heart energy into our work and our students and all of the people we're in relationship with on campus, and then going home and having to do that for our families when maybe all we need to do, all we really, really need and want is to just relax. But when you come home and your 3-year-old daughter takes you by the finger and says, let's run up the stairs, how can you say no, right? But at the same time, you know, there's that fear that at some point this light is gonna burn out, right? And so I'd love to think more about that with all of you. Thank you for being patient. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Imam Sohaib, for a fantastic reflection.